Hillary Clinton was supposed to be the most qualified candidate in U.S. history. So how come she lost to the least qualified candidate?
She just lost to this guy, and that, if anything, that should humiliate these people. I mean, that the party should be saying, you know, we need to go in a different direction. You know, what are the suggestions? We should be convening some kind of, you know, commission to completely rethink who we are. They're not doing that.
That's Thomas Frank. We talk with him about his book, Listen Liberal. It's a scathing look at what's wrong with the Democratic Party and how it got to the disastrous place it's in right now. This is Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, on PRX, and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. A fight is brewing for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. In the wake of November's catastrophic election, the progressive wing of the party is mounting a serious challenge to the center-right faction that's controlled the party since at least the Carter years, and possibly even earlier. They want the party to go back to its roots in the New Deal, back when the party won election after election. And they want Keith Ellison to head the DNC. He said he'll mount a strong 50-state strategy to win back America's middle and working classes. Obama's opposing Ellison, a head-scratcher for many Democrats who say the party must either change or die. Maybe Obama should read Thomas Frank's book, Listen Liberal. It poses the question, whatever happened to the party of the people? That's the subtitle. Then the book sets out to answer the question with a penetrating analysis of how the party turned away from its historic base in the working class to serve a professional and corporate elite. By doing so, the Democrats ceded their traditional ground to a billionaire faux populist who flogged pro-working class promises he clearly has no intention of fulfilling. That is, if one is to judge from the anti-labor, anti-social security, and anti-healthcare billionaires with which he's packing his cabinet. This is a tragedy for Americans and the Democrats, one for which the Democrats have mostly themselves to blame. As Frank points out, when they threw their base under the bus of NAFTA, mass incarceration, and the abolition of welfare, they destroyed the lives of millions of Americans and reaped a whirlwind of rage in return. Thomas Frank is the author of Pity the Billionaire, The Wrecking Crew, and What's the Matter with Kansas? A former columnist for The Wall Street Journal and Harper's, he's the founding editor of The Baffler. Well, Thomas Frank, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
So in your book, Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, now you wrote this book and published it before the election. And before we kind of dive into the book itself, I wonder if you could just say something about how you felt after the election in light of the book that you wrote.
Well, that's a... First of all, let me say, I wrote it in 2015, and it was published in March of 2016. And I'm, you know, working on a very slightly updated version. It really doesn't take much, believe me. I mean, the trajectory is all there already. How did I feel about the election? Well, you know, on the one hand, I think it's going to be very, you know, I think that the Trump administration is probably going to be very bad for the country. On the other hand, well, it's a crazy thing to see what you have described and what you've spent so long working on, to see it play out in exactly the same way as you've described. It's a very curious feeling. It's a mixture of emotions, let's say.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you wrote an article for The Guardian after the election, how the Democrats could win again if they wanted. I think the emphasis is on if they wanted. You write in it that winning is supposed to be the raison d'etre of centrism, centrism being the reigning, value, supposedly, of the Democratic Party. at least the one that it purports to be. And it didn't work out so well.
Yeah, well, that's the irony. I mean, there's many, many, many ironies. A billionaire presenting himself as the defender of working class people, you know. there's so many ironies this year, but that one is particularly pungent. And what I'm describing there when I say that, so Listen Liberal is about the sort of triumph of the centrist philosophy in the Democratic Party, the Clinton philosophy. And one of the reasons that it, the way that philosophy would rationalize itself to everyone else in the Democratic Party, that centrism, you know, it sold you out on all sorts of different issues, and it was, you know, it was disappointing in all sorts of ways, but it had this saving virtue of winning, you know, that it failed in all these other ways, but it, at least it won elections. So you could criticize Bill Clinton for this and for that and, you know, for doing all these terrible things, but he did get elected, and that was supposed to be the Trump card. That was the great thing about it. Well, it didn't work out this time. So we had a, you know, not just a representative of the Clinton wing, but an actual Clinton, and she did all the centrist moves, constantly talking about balancing the budget and making these, you know, and her famous friendship with Wall Street and making these overtures to the right at the Democratic convention, especially the national security right. And it didn't work. She lost anyway. And this is an extremely important point to understand and to get your head around if you care about politics.
So your book, Listen Liberal, really delves into how the Democrats lost their way. And by the way, winning was supposed to be the raison d'etre, but they haven't been doing a whole lot of winning for a whole long time.
Worse situation now than they have ever been in my lifetime, mm-hmm. You know, under the guidance of this kind of Democrat. No, it's terrible. So they've lost both houses of Congress, the presidency. And, of course, right off the bat, Trump will get to name a member of the Supreme Court. That's gone. The wipeout of Democrats in the state legislatures of the country is extraordinary. The two-party system is basically gone. And that's going too far, but the second party in the system is collapsing all over the country. So, I mean, there's, as I said, many, many, many ironies here, but it wasn't all that long ago that Democrats here in Washington were assuring anybody who would listen that they had a lock on the presidency and that they would be winning, you know, popular majorities from here to eternity. And by the way, Hillary Clinton did win a popular majority. She got more well, not quite a majority, but she got more votes than Trump did, you know. So they actually delivered on that front. The votes just weren't where they needed them to be.
Yeah, and I'd like to go back for a moment. Not all the way back, which we will do, to the beginning of the DNC, but back to Barack Obama's election in 2008. He came in on the wings of a financial crash. He swept into office with both houses of Congress in the
yep.
Democratic ranks.
The great hero, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So he had the whole majority, had the whole thing. What happened?
And people like me, who were very idealistic about him, saw him as our generation's Franklin Roosevelt. He was going to put things right, and we were, you know, off onto another New Deal. And, you know, he came into office with this very similar sort of situation that Roosevelt came in with, and the country was behind him. He could have probably got anything he wanted, although, you know, universal health care appears to have been a bridge too far, but he could have, in terms of the financial system, he probably could have had anything he wanted because the country adored him. He was a hero. You know, he had both houses of Congress, and he didn't do it. You know, when we sit around and talk about what went wrong for the Democrats, every conversation comes back to this. You know, because Barack Obama is, you know, he is the last guy that we hoped would set things right. You know, I think a much healthier mass movement than Donald Trump's mass movement, but very similar in some ways. You know, the giant rallies, talking about what had happened to working class people, and then he really didn't deliver on those promises.
I saw the writing on the wall even before he came into office, when he chose Tim Geithner and Larry Summers as his financial team. Then it was, to me, it was clear what was happening.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, a lot of people have said that to me, you know, but I'm always more optimistic about these things than other people. But no, that's exactly right. And one of the really depressing revelations of the last few months have been in the Podesta emails that got hacked and put on WikiLeaks. And if you read around in these, they go back quite a ways. They go back to 2008 when he was working for Obama. And there's an email chain in there where they're putting together Obama's cabinet. And this is before Obama has even been elected. This is in October of 2008. I mean, it was clear at that time that Obama would be elected because, you know, the world economy had already gone off the cliff at that point. You know, the financial crisis had happened. You know, the panic had set in. So it was clear that Obama was going to be elected. And here they are choosing his cabinet, okay, and these email chains. And the guy who, it's like, you know, five people who are exchanging emails with each other. And the guy who appears to be the leader, you know, who is making the recommendations, is an executive at Citibank. And, you know, when you figure that out, when you see that, it's all of a sudden everything snaps into place and you get it. You know, he never had any intention of getting tough with the financial industry. They were appointing his cabinet for him, or they were choosing his cabinet for him, I should say. So, yeah, your reaction was exactly right. The hope was pretty much drained out even before his administration began.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Thomas Frank about his book, Listen Liberal. And it's emblematic of what you call the triumvirate of Democrats, meritocrats, and plutocrats.
So, meritocrats, yeah, yeah.
Meritocrats, is that how you do it?
Yeah, yeah, it's like in meritocracy.
Right.
I mean, it's a word I made up, but still, that's how I pronounce it. So I made it up so I get to pronounce it.
Well, thank you for that. So unpack that.
Yeah, so that's the modern Democratic Party. It's Listen Liberal starts with Obama's failure to do what needed to be done with the financial system in 2009 and 2010. But that is just, you know, we can talk about the immediate reasons why he failed, which you and I have just been talking about, but then there's the grander reasons. You know, why did a guy at Citibank have that power over him in the first place? And all of these questions, all the questions that I ask and Listen Liberal, keep coming back to the same thing. It's the Democratic Party is not what we think it is. It's not a party, you know, of working people, which it often says it is. It's not the party of the people in the sort of Andrew Jackson sense. It's not that at all. It's a party of the sort of highly educated, white-collar professionals, people who are doing very well. You know, these are people with advanced degrees, people who tend to be in the upper 10% of the income distribution. And that's really the demographic group that the Democratic Party speaks to and imagines itself being representative of. That's who they think of as their number one constituency. And that's what I mean when I say meritocrats. These are people who believe that they deserve what they have, and the reason they deserve it is because they did so well in school, or because they went to a particular kind of Ivy League, you know, college, or they, you know, did well in graduate school, or they're very accomplished in their profession. You know, you take someone like Hillary Clinton, where during the campaign, we were constantly reminded of her resume. I mean, she basically ran as a resume candidate. And
the most
Barack
qualified.
Obama, say that again?
The most qualified candidate
ever. The most qualified
ever.
Presidential candidate ever, Barack Obama said. Yeah, that's a funny way to run for the presidency, by talking about your resume as though it were, you know, as though it were that kind of job, rather than, you know, something requiring vision and ideology. Democrats are always drawn back to that. Remember Michael Dukakis in the 80s?
I remember him well. I was in Massachusetts.
There was no ideology. It was just a, you know, you just it was just a matter of expertise and of making things run correctly. How did he had a way of putting it that you know, that he was beyond ideology. But Democrats are always drawn to that kind of person. Barack Obama has this very inspiring side where, you know, he's this wonderful public speaker and he says these, he has this way with words and he says these wonderful things, but he also has this very wonkish side. And so did Bill Clinton and, you know, Al Gore. Oh my God. You know, well, that's really who they are. That's what they always go for, this personality type. Now, why is that? It's because that's how they understand themselves, as the representative of that class of Americans. And so they, you know, they look at these guys on Wall Street, you know, the math PhDs or the you know, the Harvard lawyers who run your Wall Street banks, and they see colleagues, peers. You know, they don't see people who are ripping off the world or crooks or anything like that. They see accomplished professionals. That's, you know, that's, that is the dirty, dark secret to the whole thing. It's really banal when it comes right down to it.
But is it just this kind of psychological affinity or and their core economic interests that they've aligned with the plutocratic class? I mean, but when you think of the money that comes pouring in from Wall Street to the Democratic Party, for example.
Well, that's an added benefit, but I think it's not psychological. This is more sociological. It's class. That they have a shared class interest and a shared class perspective and a shared way of looking at the world with these guys, and you know, it runs pretty deep. Now, I should point out that, you know, as we all know, the Republicans still have very, very wealthy people supporting them, the Koch brothers, the 1%. And what this tells us is that there's more than one, you know, kind of rich person in America. There's variety. There's differences among rich people as well as among everybody else. And so what I've been saying all along is that there's different hierarchies of wealth and power in America, and the Republicans speak to one of them, which is a sort of hierarchy of business, you know, of people who think that they've worked their way up in the world. And the Democrats speak to this kind of hierarchy of status, of educational achievement, you know, which is what props up professionalism, you know, and the sort of professional hierarchy. And so these are two different hierarchies, and they tend to view the world in very different ways. And what you said about the money is very true. You know, when it comes to economic questions, the two groups are very similar. You know, your centrist Democrats are, you know, interested in balancing the budget and doing all these sorts of things that Republicans also say they're interested in doing. But on social issues, the two groups tend to be very far apart. You know, the culture war issues. That's, they're willing to fight and fight and fight over those things. But on economic issues, yeah, they're very similar. And you asked about all the money that comes into the Democrats. You know, I think that that's a big part of the story. But what is really fascinating when I did the research for Listen Liberal is that the Democrats made their move towards the rich, towards the professionals, you know, white-collar elite. They made their move towards those people long before money was a big deal in politics. Mm-hmm. So this is in the early 70s. This is before any of our big campaign finance scandals. Well, except for Watergate, that was of course that was happening at the time. But before really big money had gone into politics, they made this choice
with Hubert Humphrey. Is that right?
Yeah. It was after Humphrey's defeat is when they decided to do this. And they were very open about this. This is you know, they wrote magazine articles about it, books about it. They had a commission that steered the Democrats away from organized labor and towards the professional class, and their hearings were open. They kept notes on what they did. It's all very well known what they did, and yeah, they decided basically we don't want to be the party of organized labor anymore. We don't want to be the party of the New Deal anymore. Except for, I mean, they'll always claim, you know, they always want they want unions money, and they want to claim that they're the party of the people. But what they really wanted to be was the party of this enlightened suburban liberals, white-collar elite. And they did. That is what they became. And it has never been a very successful strategy in electoral terms. You know, obviously McGovern went down to this terrible disaster, and the victories that they have had since then, they've just barely squeaked by. You look at Bill Clinton, you know, and he was, or Barack Obama. Well, Obama didn't squeak by. He won in an enormous landslide, but that's because people, like I said earlier, saw him as another Franklin Roosevelt. Anyhow, that's who the Democrats are. There's this continuity from that time up to this. And I think that the money is, in some ways, is secondary. They really do see themselves as a party of the white-collar elite. And the money that the white-collar elite is able to steer their way is, you know, that is an added benefit, but that's not essential to how they see the world. But having said that, I mean, let's talk about that for a second. Hillary Clinton outraised Donald Trump 2-1 and outspent Donald Trump 2-1. That's amazing that that happened. Barack Obama outraised John McCain specifically, well, in general, but also specifically on Wall Street, which had never happened before. You know, they have become the darlings of the financial industry and of Big Pharma and of Silicon Valley.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Thomas Frank about his book, Listen Liberal.
And so it's hard sometimes to tell, you know, where their economic interest, where their sociological interest ends and their economic interest starts. You know,
yeah, that's right.
I wanted to ask you something, too. Your previous book, a bestseller, was What's the Matter with Kansas? Kansas was a center at the end of the 19th century of the populist movement. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. Now, I have been seeing, you know, the New York Times is talking about populism, and
yeah,
every single time what they are talking about is the extreme right, as if populism actually is not something that has anything to do with the democratic wishes of the people, as I understood the populists to be.
Yeah, well, yes, Donald Trump has really ruined this word. I used to speak in Europe. I've been using the word populist for a long time to describe different movements. And I used to speak in Europe about it, and they always used it in Europe as in the same way that the New York Times is using it now to describe basically racist and nativist movements. And I would say, no. You have to remember there's the original populists were really good guys, and they were on the right side of these questions, and they, you know, there's a good populism. You know? And that has really been wiped out of late.
Yeah.
And although I think of, you know, Bernie Sanders had a populist streak to him, but populism is, you know, Andrew Jackson, William Jennings Bryan, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, of course. There's a good side to populism. Now, if you want to talk about the uppercase P populists in Kansas, you know, I love talking about that, and you just have to look out because I'll talk your ear off.
Oh, well, just briefly, you know, talk about the fact that they brought to these were farmers and working people who were black and white.
Well, that's right. So populism was really interesting in that regard. That this is not so much in Kansas, which is a very white place, but in the South. Populism was all over the Midwest and all over the South, wherever you had a lot of farmers. And in the South, the populists deliberately tried to build a biracial movement that was going to appeal to white farmers as well as black farmers, who at the time, this is before Jim Crow really had got going. And so in a lot of places in the South, black people could still vote at the time. And so they tried to bring these two groups together, and they had a certain amount of success with that. In fact, they had so much success that they really scared the hell out of the dominant, you know, the sort of planter class in the South. And that was the beginning of Jim Crow, was an effort to stamp out populism in the South. But yeah, they were pretty good on that, on those issues. But it was a in the Midwest, it was a farmer and worker kind of thing, and you still see echoes of it in places like Minnesota and North Dakota, although it has really died out. Instead, the kind of language of populism, where it's the common people, it's class language, basically. It's about the common working people against the elite, has really been hijacked by the right in all sorts of ways. And this goes back many years, but you look at something like the Reagan years, where it's where Reagan is using this sort of populist language. But they've been doing it for a long time. This is what What's the Matter with Kansas was about how the right uses the language of populism. And it has really achieved terrible things for these people. You know, you look at Kansas, where it was what really swung that place to the right in recent years, in the 90s, was working class people banding together, organizing themselves, and electing these very right-wing people, and the result of all that is the guy who's governor right now, Sam Brownback, who's just a disaster for the state and specifically for those kind of people. Mm-hmm. It's really the Kansas story is both kind of hopeful and also just in a terrible tragedy. And I say hopeful because, it's about ordinary people organizing themselves and taking over a political party and achieving victory from the grassroots up. Now, then the victory they achieve has turned to ashes.
Right.
But
yeah, and from Kansas to the country now, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's everywhere now.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Thomas Frank about his newest book, Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. So, yeah, the Party of the People, just for those of our listeners who may not be really clear on the New Deal, just in brief, tell us, what was the Democratic Party like when it was the Party of the People?
Yeah. Well, that phrase is something that they use going back to their founding. Andrew Jackson and Thomas Jefferson. And these guys had an idea. It's the same thing that I just described with populism, that what politics boiled down to in America was the people versus the powerful, people versus money. And one party in America, and in a very rough sense, they're right about that, that one party has always represented, or not always, but that you have two general interests. One is of, common people, and one is of the financial industry. And that's the founding of the other party, the Federalists, with Alexander Hamilton, or the modern-day Republicans. And that's the basic idea. And it has, at times it means it seems very silly. The Democrats are obviously corrupt, in the 19th century, and they're not really interested in the common people at all, especially if those people happen to be black. And then at other times, the promise of this has been very real. So you mentioned the Roosevelt administration. That's the sort of foundational story of our modern Democratic Party is the years of the Great Depression and World War II. When Roosevelt was president and came down like a ton of bricks on the banks, which had caused the Great Depression, and brought in a regulated economy and won World War II and had all of the various New Deal programs, the most important of which are still alive today, like Social Security. And by the way, I thank God every day for Social Security. My own family is living testimony for why this program is a good idea, why you need something like this, why even the smartest people try to save for their own retirement and something goes wrong. Mm-hmm. You need to have a program like this just in case.
And Paul Ryan also was raised with the help of Social Security in his family, and yet it seems like, I mean, the attack on Social Security and Medicare seems to be really ramping up.
Yep, it does. And that will be, of course, we talk about the horrible irony of these populist movements, and that will be the worst of all, because obviously, Social Security and Medicare, these are the great two of the greatest achievements of the Democratic Party. You know, these are the monuments of the Democratic Party. And they are very popular programs to this day. And nobody wants them to be repealed or to be cut. People want them to work. People want them to be fixed. But and they do work, by the way. They're very efficient programs. I'm a big supporter, obviously, of programs like that. And it'll be highly ironic if Donald Trump, you know, now that he's president, if he oversees the dismantling or privatizing of these programs, because, of course, he promised up and down and sideways in his campaign that he would never do such a thing, and that he was a different Republican because he would not countenance doing something like that. And, well, we shall see. But you're exactly right that this is a traditional goal of the Paul Ryan wing of the Republican Party, is to privatize these programs or somehow to undermine them. They've wanted to do this ever since these programs were started, because they understand something about them that I think Democrats often forget, that because Social Security has helped people out so much and has saved so many people from old age poverty, you know, which used to be a very real thing in this country, because that program has worked as well as it has, people are willing to countenance other government programs. It's the sort of foundation stone, the cornerstone of, you know, an activist government. Social Security is.
And yet it's not just Paul Ryan. I have, you know, you can go on YouTube and hear Clinton and Paul Ryan, Bill Clinton and Paul Ryan, talking to each other when they didn't know that their mic was still on. And with the implication that, you know, once that they would work together, basically, to privatize Medicare. I mean, that is the implication. And we know that Barack Obama convened this panel for a grand bargain that really involved the same thing.
Yes. So Democrats are, although they're identified with Social Security, their record here is not good in recent years, especially the centrist wing. So Bill Clinton, if you study his administration, one of the things people don't know about his time in the White House was that he did strike a secret deal with Newt Gingrich to partially privatize Social Security. And they would have done it. I mean, Gingrich had the votes and Clinton was ready to sign it, and they had it all worked out, what it would entail. Basically, the dream that these guys have had for a very long time is to force people, instead of, you know, putting your, you know, having money taken out of your paycheck and invested in treasury bonds or whatever they're invested in, you know, they're invested with the government, basically, in the safest financial instrument there is. But the dream has always been to stop doing that and to instead basically force people to invest their money in stocks with Wall Street. And that's basically what Clinton and Gingrich agreed to do. And the whole thing was they were ready to do it. This is in the very late 90s. And then the Monica Lewinsky scandal erupted and completely stopped them. And by the way, this is not me spinning conspiracy theories. This has been written about by people, historians who found the documents and who interviewed the participants, interviewed Gingrich, interviewed Clinton's representative. What was his name? Erskine Bowles. By the way, the same guy that Obama turned to for his grand bargain. This is all well known now that they plan to do this. And yeah, this is, you know, that's centrism for you.
Thomas Frank. We're talking with him about his book, Listen Liberal. It's a scathing dissection of how the Democratic Party went wrong when it abandoned its traditional working class base in order to serve the interests of the professional and corporate elite. Stay tuned for more after the break.
I cheered when Humphrey was chosen, my faith in the system restored. And I'm glad that the commies were thrown out from the AFL-CIO board. And I love Puerto Ricans and Negroes as long as they don't move next door. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal. Ah, the people of old Mississippi should all hang their heads in shame. Now I can't understand how their minds work. What's the matter, don't they watch Les Crane? But if you ask me to bus my children, I hope the cops take down your name. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. What's wrong with the Democratic Party? How come the so-called Party of the People has lost now not only the White House, but also, since Barack Obama was elected, both houses of Congress, and gone down to defeat in a slew of state legislators and governorships? The party's at a nadir and may not survive. And yes, we know that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, and we also know that the relentless Republican policies of voter suppression and gerrymandering have stacked the deck against Democrats. But still, Thomas Frank's book, Listen Liberal, shows why the Democrats have been unable to marshal the large majorities they enjoyed before they turned away from the New Deal, majorities that could have overwhelmed all the tricks Republicans have thrown at them. Before the break, we were talking about how the attack on New Deal programs like Social Security and Medicare had been mounted by Democrats like Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, as well as Republicans. Another policy with devastating effects on Americans has been mass incarceration, something Bill Clinton signed into law with a 1994 crime bill. Let's turn to mass incarceration, Thomas Frank. In Listen Liberal, you say that mass incarceration was essential to Clintonism. Why?
It's discipline. Are you familiar with the term neoliberalism?
Very. And actually, but I didn't know that it actually had the origins with the Democratic Party.
Well, no, it doesn't. That's just a coincidence. It's a weird coincidence, though. That neoliberalism is the reason I asked if you're familiar with it, is it's a British term. And what they mean by that is, for them, the liberals in the 19th century, you know, like the Gladstone Party, they were the ultimate believers in the free market, you know, in free trade and free markets and no regulation and this sort of thing. So that when they talk about neoliberalism to refer to our modern, like, age of market worship, you know, which sounds really strange to us here in America because we think of liberalism as being something very different. But basically, the whole religion of the market is that, you know, it entails freedom for one, complete liberty for one industry, for one class of people, financiers, and at the same time, discipline for working people, for people at the bottom. You know, huge discipline. So what happened in the 30s or the 1970s with strikes all over the place and absenteeism and basically working people getting the idea that they get to retire and they get to take it easy and they don't have to work really hard and they have a say in how the factory is supposed to be run, you know, which is what unions are about and which is what all of retirement is about and having vacation time and all that stuff. That has to go away in neoliberalism. So one class of people gets complete license, you know, Wall Street, and another class of people gets discipline. And mass incarceration, you know, the big prison roundup, that's a huge part of discipline for working people. That is essential to it, you know, putting a big part of the working class population essentially in jail. I mean, that is the ultimate in teaching them discipline or forcing discipline upon them. Another big element in that is welfare reform, which Clinton also got done, where basically the welfare program, you know, this is something that I remember. This was another New Deal program where it was called Aid to Families with Dependent Children. And, you know, the program, again, had a lot of problems. But the essence of it was a really important, you know, thing, which is that single mothers, single women with children should not be poor, you know, should have enough to eat and should be able to, that we should all be looking after them. And yes, the program had, it had a lot of problems in the way it was administered and that sort of thing. But instead of reforming it, they did away with it. The program doesn't exist anymore. It was replaced by these state-level welfare agencies that, you know, that sometimes work and sometimes don't. Depends on what kind of state you're in. You know, if you're in New York State, it's probably pretty generous. If you're in Kansas, it isn't. And what this is about also was pushing these people into the workforce. Now, again, I'm not making this up, and I'm not, it's not a conspiracy theory, and I'm not reading between the lines. This is what the Clinton people said. This is about making people work.
It's interesting because Nixon actually was at one point in favor of a minimum guaranteed income.
I know, we've gone so far from that. Isn't that funny?
It's amazing. But, you know, mass incarceration has disproportionately affected African Americans and other minorities, whereas the end of welfare has really affected poor and working class people across the board. So what part of that, you know, in terms of mass incarceration, I wonder if you could talk about the role of, I mean, I think of it as divide and conquer, but the Clintons and Clintonism has made a big deal about identity politics. So I put this together.
Well, I mean, let me just say, first of all, mass incarceration, and, you know, this is one of the cruelest measures ever undertaken by any government in a free society that I know of. And a big part of it, so this is the 94 crime bill. And by the way, when I was writing Listen Liberal, this is before Black Lives Matter had started and before any of this stuff was in the headlines. And I was researching Listen Liberal and I, you know, looking up the achievements of the Clinton administration. And they used to be very proud of this, the 1994 crime bill, which, you know, he got passed. And it actually had some good things in it. They banned assault weapons, for example. The ban isn't with us any longer. Of course, that part of it is gone. But they did all these other things. You know, went on this prison building spree, invented all of these new capital punishment. You know, made all of these things subject to capital punishment. The mandatory minimum sentencing, they invented that. You know, terrible, terrible things. These are things that are designed to just, you know, to imprison enormous numbers of people. And the worst part of it was, do you mind if I get into the weeds here? I mean, we have to talk about some details here.
Go ahead.
There was a rule that crack cocaine was treated as 100 times the punishment of powder cocaine, although chemically they're the same thing. If you were caught with one, your penalty was 100 times what it was for the other. Okay. And obviously crack by that point was, it was well known. This was a drug that was almost entirely used by black people. And so these punishments fell massively disproportionately on black people. Okay, the crime bill of 94 says, well, this should be, you know, the U.S. Sentencing Commission should look into this and decide what to do. The Sentencing Commission looks into it and decides that the powder versus crack disparity, sentencing disparity, is racist and is going to lead to mass incarceration. They don't use that term, but they say basically it's going to fill the prisons with, you know, with these people. And so this is unfair. This is racist, and we hereby overturn it. That's great. Okay, that happened about a year after the crime bill was passed. By that time, Gingrich and company have taken over Congress, and they overturn this. And they say no, we're going to keep the crack versus cocaine disparity, sentencing disparity, and they pass a law to that effect. Okay, so it goes to Bill Clinton. And if he had vetoed what they did, then boom, it would be over. The two drugs would be treated exactly the same. And Clinton didn't do that. He did not veto it. He signed it. He signed his name on that piece of legislation, and that became the law of the land and was the law of the land for many years. And it blows my mind that he did that. He did that about a week after he gave a famous speech deploring mass incarceration.
Wow.
He deplores mass incarceration of black people, you know, and he talks about the statistics. You know, he was always very good with these numbers, and he, you know, and he seems to really care and feel really bad about what's happening to these people. And then he, a week later, he signs the bill. Now, how is that possible? You know, and this is, by the way, this is not because he didn't know what he was doing. The Black Caucus, the Congressional Black Caucus, implored him not to do it. You had the Million Man March. You know, they begged him not to do it. There were riots in prisons all over America when it was clear that he was going to sign the bill. He knew what he was doing. And you just like you marvel at this. And this is the same guy that later became, you know, friends with Nelson Mandela. And you're like, how could Mandela even touch him?
Yes. Why? I mean, I know you see this, you know, and I agree in many ways. I know you see this as a sociological phenomenon, the idea of discipline. But I also think of how Hillary Clinton had huge donations from the prison industry.
Yeah, there's that, too. I mean, this is obviously this goes far beyond. This is a terrible. This is an. I brought up Nelson Mandela deliberately. This is like a South Africa level, you know, that kind of level of awfulness. Yes, it is beyond. It is beyond the sort of shared sociological vision. And I think it's also beyond what people often say is that Clinton did it because, you know, he needs to get reelected and this would, you know, this would make the sort of Reagan Democrats, this would, you know, the law and order voters, this would please them. Maybe that is why he did it, but at some point the cost is so outrageous. The cost is so great. Mm-hmm. You know, is it worth it? You know, the 4 more years of Bill Clinton, you know, that's just great. And this whole generation had to pay.
Right. And also workers have paid in other ways. One of the things...
Well, NAFTA. He ruined them, too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's where I was going, because you also talk about what you call the innovation fetish or innovation liberalism, which... really did come in as the, you know, as the remedy to the jobs that were lost in NAFTA. I remember talking to Robert Reich, who I know has changed his mind on this since then, but he was one of the first people I interviewed for my show back in 2004, and he had written a book in which he said the whole, you know, remedy to losing jobs was more training.
Yep,
you skewer
well,
this.
The work of nations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the book that Clinton loved, by the way. It was very important to Clinton's, you know, to what Clinton wanted to do. It was all, you know, we would enter the new economy, you know, that great phrase from the Clinton years, and people who were casualties would have to do get retraining. You know, they'd retrain and enter the workforce in some different way. It was just you know, complete fantasy. Sorry.
I'm very
negative about these things. But both of them, I mean, look at how these things have reverberated down to our own time. I mean, NAFTA, which Clinton did, remember, this is not Reagan that got NAFTA done. It was Clinton. It was not Bush. It was Clinton. Clinton got it done. Republicans could not get it through Congress. It took a Democrat to do that. And he did it over the bodies of organized labor, who, again, just like the Congressional Black Caucus and mass incarceration, they implored him not to do it. You know, and they begged him not to do it, and they fought him and fought him and fought him, and he did it. He did it anyways, and he ruined those people. And then he did it, you know, he proceeded to get all of these different trade agreements done, and he ruined those people. And we try to brush that off now, but this was an enormous political battle, and working people lost. And they know it, and they still resent it to this day. And there's a reason why that was Trump's number one issue, you know, trade deals, because working people are still pissed off about this. And here's Hillary Clinton, you know, the who was Bill Clinton's right-hand gal, you know, she was his big advisor. She is uniquely vulnerable on this issue. And the Democrats' response to all of this, you know, to any time you start complaining about this, you know, when they start talking about innovation and that sort of thing, they're still doing that. They're still that's what they talk about to this day. You know, Hillary Clinton talked about it all the time on the campaign trail. We have to encourage innovation. You know, you look at the Podesta emails. Their interactions with Silicon Valley are amazing. Eric Schmidt was running some kind of high-tech startup that was supposed to be helping Hillary Clinton, you know. Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, is very closely associated with the Democrats. But that really is their class vision, their sort of sociological vision. You know, professionals, innovative people win, working people lose. They think that's how things ought to be.
Mm. Yeah, the startup mentality. I was just reading an article recently about how startups, you know, are really not the way to increase employment in America.
No, of course not. They're startups, so by definition, no. I mean, we all want companies to start, and we want people to launch companies and all this sort of thing. But these are, first of all, they're small companies by definition, and second of all, they don't employ a whole lot of people. I mean, you're talking about almost always high-tech startups, people designing, you know, software for iPhones and stuff like that. You know, these do not tend to be large employers of people. It's the opposite. They're looking for some way to corner a market or get around some regulation. Like, that's the genius of Uber. That's what's so great about Uber, is that it gets around, you know, the rules governing taxis.
And labor law.
Yeah, that's right. It's a way to circumvent the law. And that's what many, many, many of these innovations are. I mean, by definition, that's what they are. They're not there to increase employment or anything like that. They're there to find ways around the laws and the rules and the social conventions that did guarantee people employment.
Well, Thomas Frank, at the end of your book, Listen, Liberal, you say that the Democrats have no interest in reforming themselves, and there's little the rest of us can do to build a third-party movement, I think, given, you know,
yeah,
the way...
Yeah, I'm sorry, I do say that, and I'm very negative about that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and then you say what we can do is strip away the Democrats' precious sense of their own moral property. Is that really enough?
No, of course it isn't. It's just a beginning. And by itself, it won't do anything more than just, you know, embarrass them. And I think they're incapable of being embarrassed. I mean, if anything should have embarrassed them, it's what just happened to them. That Hillary Clinton just lost to this insult clown. it's inconceivable. But it happened.
The least qualified candidate in U.S. history.
Yeah. Yes, she just lost to this guy. And that, if anything, that should humiliate these people. I mean, that the party should be saying, you know, we need to go in a different direction. You know, what are the suggestions? We should be convening some kind of, you know, commission to completely rethink who we are. They're not doing that. I mean, Clinton and her people have all been badly embarrassed, but the dominant faction is still the dominant faction, and it's going to be hard to unseat these people. Very hard.
What's it going to take?
If I were to say, like defeat in elections, it's obviously going to take a lot more than that, because they just got massively defeated. I mean, we shall see. I mean, I don't want to give up all hope yet. You've got very hopeful signs. Keith Ellison, this is a guy who really gets it, a congressman from Minnesota, and there's a chance, a really good chance, that he's going to be the head of the Democratic National Committee. Now, that's not enough to change, you know, a party's direction. It's going to take a lot more than that. And, you know, I don't know where that change is going to come from. Maybe Bernie Sanders. I mean, for God's sakes, he looks really good right now. You know, here's a guy who is right about nearly everything. Elizabeth Warren is looking really good right now. So we shall see. I mean, the war is on within the Democratic Party. And I don't want to say that anything could happen, because I feel like, you know, I'm very reluctant to ever be that optimistic. But there is one lesson to take away from Trump's victory, which is that anything can happen. I mean, no one predicted this. No one saw it coming. And she outspent him 2-1. She was ahead in every poll. You know, he didn't know what he was doing. He was completely incompetent, and he won anyway. That shows you that anything is possible in American politics. So never give up hope.
I wanted to ask you one last thing, which is, I remember during the election, Susan Sarandon, for whom I have an enormous amount of respect, went on MSNBC and seemed to imply that, well, you know, if Trump wins, you know, maybe that's not such a bad thing because it will mean the revolution. And, you know, I always am suspicious of...
Why do people say things like that? That's
what I want to... I mean, in some ways... Many people do think that it'll be easier to fight against Trump than it would have been to fight against Hillary Clinton on, you know, the regressive policies or anti-working people policies that they both would be likely to put in. But weigh in on this idea.
There'll be moral clarity, but just think of what this guy is going to be able to get done. You know, liberals have been sitting around moaning about how Barack Obama, you know, the presidency is not a powerful office and the president can't get anything done. You know, they say all these things just to get Obama off the hook. You watch Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. He's going to get things done. He's going to get a lot of things done, and they're going to be really awful things, you know, because he's got both houses of Congress. I mean, they can probably amend the Constitution if they put their minds to it. You know, these guys are in the saddle like no one. Like, I mean, they have more power now than we've seen ever. They're going to do terrible things. And no, there's not going to be a revolution in America. The idea is ridiculous. This is, you know, like organized labor is weaker today than it has ever been in my lifetime. This is a bad thing that Donald Trump has become president. Now, yeah, it gives you some moral clarity, and maybe that's really awesome in Hollywood, but no, this is not good.
Well, Thomas Frank, your book is Listen Liberal or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. It's a terrific read, and it's the level of just sheer satire is a delight to read. You know, it's kind of
it's satire mixed with some horror, you know?
Exactly. You're crying and laughing at the same time. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Thomas Frank is the author of Pity the Billionaire, The Wrecking Crew, and What's the Matter with Kansas? A former columnist for The Wall Street Journal and Harper's, he's the founding editor of The Baffler. Read or listen to an excerpt from Listen Liberal by going to writersvoice.net. We've got about a minute left, just enough time to share with you some of the great fiction I've been reading lately, but haven't scheduled for the show, at least not yet. First is Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad. It's a searing novel about slavery with a twist on reality. The Underground Railroad isn't merely a network to bring slaves into freedom, but an actual railroad underground. Otherwise, the realism is almost too much to bear as we follow the story of a young woman who manages the nearly impossible to escape from slavery. Another wonderful novel, a mystery driven by the physics of parallel universes, is Dark Matter by Blake Crouch. It follows a character who's thrown into parallel universes to his own and has to find his way back to his original wife and son. It's a terrific romp that asks thorny questions about identity. And another terrific novel is Indelible, a debut by Adelia Saunders. It has three protagonists, a young woman who was born with the ability to see facts about people's lives written on their skin. Also, the young man who falls in love with her, and the young man's father, who's looking for clues to the life of his own mother, a famous writer who died of a terrible, self-inflicted wound. The novel is tautly plotted, and the characters and writing are memorable. This one I'll try to schedule for Writer's Voice. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.